This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org. and www.acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on these websites and at affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to David Cooper, who's a senior economic analyst at EPI and the deputy director of something called EARN, Economic Analysis Research Network, EARN, E-A-R-N. David, welcome to Wade's World.
Thanks for having me, Wade. Great to be here.
Well, I saw your name connected to a report about something new in Crazy Town that doesn't have to do with the White House. Actually, has to do with the Washington, D.C. City Council, and more importantly, given our listeners, an issue around tip workers. What's the background on this?
Yeah, so it is a crazy story. What happened is back in June during the primary elections, there was a ballot measure put on the ballot here in D.C. Called Initiative 77. And what Initiative 77 does is it would raise the tipped minimum wage. Now, this is the minimum wage that employers can pay any worker that receives tips from its current level, which in the District of Columbia is $3.89 per hour. Just to say that again, employers in the District of Columbia can pay their tipped staff $3.89 per hour currently. Initiative 77 would gradually raise that amount up until it was equal to the regular minimum wage in D.C. by 2026. So it would raise it about $1.50 an hour. By 2026, it would be somewhere around $15 an hour, which is where the D.C. Regular minimum wage is scheduled to go in the next few years anyway. So basically
that's
what it would do is...
That's a process. That's 8 years.
Yeah, exactly. And they do that intentionally because this is a policy change that you want to give businesses time to adjust. So you do it on a gradual basis, give them a period of time to change their pay system. Well, Initiative 77 passed. It passed with overwhelming support. I think the final vote count was 56-44, so a 12-point margin.
Election, we call that a butt whipping, don't we, David? if Trump had been elected that way, we'd hear about it even more every day.
It's a pretty clear signal, if you ask me, what the voters want. Unfortunately, the very next day, the mayor and the chairperson of the D.C. Council came out and said that they were going to introduce a bill to repeal Initiative 77, and that's what they've done. And there was a hearing on the bill on Monday of this past week that I testified at, and it was just an absolute circus. I've never seen a hearing like this, just the complete animosity and dismissiveness of workers who came out to testify and say that this current system harms them. The council members that many of them, not all of them, but many of them basically have said, you know, we don't believe that this is a problem and we're just going to overturn the will of the voters.
Now, did these same politicians campaign against the measure? And, I mean, this was a vote, so people, I don't know about most elections, but everybody who was against this thing passing probably had a fair chance to campaign against it. And politicians usually have a lot of weight in a city-initiated ordinance campaign.
Yeah, there was a huge campaign against it, well, both for and against it, and a number of council members came out in advance of the election either supporting or being against the initiative. Others said, you know what, I'm going to wait and listen to what the voters say, see what the outcome of the election is. Unfortunately, when the outcome was apparent that the initiative had passed, some of those same folks basically went back on their word and said, you know what, I don't really care what the will of the voters was. I don't think I want to overturn this. And that's unfortunate. You know, I think the argument that they've made is that this is a primary election and that there wasn't high enough turnout for the results to be valid. And I just think that that is an incredibly dangerous precedent to set, to basically say, if we didn't like the outcome of this election, we're just going to say that this election wasn't valid. That's not the way democracy works.
Well, and furthermore, I mean, let's be frank about it. Usually people who oppose an ordinance force you to go to the primary election, assuming you won't have enough turnout to pass it. I mean,
yeah.
These kinds of elections I know too well go to the runner, not to the, I mean, only if you can get to the general election. So the fact that they won by this vote in a primary should have told supposedly elected leaders in D.C. to shut their mouth and go forward. But let's take a look at this, because our listeners in most areas are not as lucky as those in D.C., so they're still at a tipped wage of $2.13 an hour against a minimum wage federally of $7.25.
Right.
So we're talking in D.C., where we've usually seen some of the most progressive steps. I mean, back 20 years ago almost, when we did a living wage ordinance here in New Orleans, we were following the numbers of D.C., which had just tacked a dollar at that point on the federal minimum wage to try to get it passed. But what was the reception to your report? Let's go through some of the facts you tried to get on this, regardless of the politics, and we'll come back to the politics.
Sure. So, you know, the arguments being made by opponents of the initiative are pretty much the same arguments you hear any time there's a minimum wage increase proposed anywhere. Same arguments they've been making for 100 years, that if you raise the minimum wage, that's going to lead to just massive business closures, people being laid off, and the workers you're trying to help are ultimately going to be hurt by the policy. Now, this is probably the most studied topic in labor economics.
Absolutely.
And the academic research is so clear on this. The conclusion of the overwhelming majority of economists is that moderate increases in minimum wages, at least increases of the size that we've done in the past, have never led to any significant impact on employment, that businesses figure out ways to adapt. Workers make more money, and at the end of the day, you have a system where you have more folks who not only have a more secure standard of living, but have more spending power, and they go out and they spend those dollars, and it supports the very businesses that have to pay a little bit more to their workers.
And the studies that I know of have established that even though there may be some jobs left, it's de minimis. I mean, in New Orleans, the study said 100 jobs possibly would be lost if minimum wage is raised. In Los Angeles, Los Angeles obviously much bigger than New Orleans at the time they moved the living wage there, but it was peanuts compared to the huge benefits of raising the wage. So I don't know how they get around that.
Yeah, it's a really distorted way that these proposals are evaluated. You know, there's oftentimes the opposition likes to make the claim that if there's a single job lost, then this is a bad policy. But they're completely ignoring the tens of thousands, if not hundreds, if not millions of people who are going to get a boost in their paychecks. So, yeah, it is a very distorted comparison. So, anyway, the way that, you know, this has played out here in D.C., or the way that my research, the reason why I did my research is not only to remind folks of that existing academic research, but to just paint a picture of who D.C. tip workers are, and remind them also that this is the way that that tipped work operates in eight states in the country. Back out west in California, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, Hawaii, Nevada, even Montana, tipped workers in all those states get the regular minimum wage before tips right now, and they have for years. So the notion that D.C. and other states couldn't move to this model just doesn't ring true. When businesses, restaurants in particular, have been operating this way in other states for decades, and they've figured out how to make it work. So my study talks about, you know, shows that if you look at the wages of tipped workers in cities that already have this, what they call one fair wage policy, in other words, all workers get the same minimum wage. I look specifically at workers in Seattle and San Francisco, where tipped workers there are getting $15 an hour before tips. What you see is that workers there take home more money. They take home about 20% more per hour than their counterparts here in the District of Columbia. And even though restaurant growth, employment growth in those two cities has been a little bit slower than D.C. over the past 2 years, or excuse me, the past 4 years, it's still been growing. The industry is still growing. The industry is still thriving. And tipped work is still a big part of the economy there. It's about the same share of the overall private sector as it is here in D.C. So again, the idea that this is going to lead to the destruction of the industry and the sky is going to fall, there's just no data to back that up. Empirically, it's just simply not true.
We're talking to David Cooper, who's the deputy director of EARN and a senior economic analyst at the Economic Policy Institute in D.C. We're talking about tip workers and how they're paid both in D.C. and elsewhere. David, one of the things that's so curious about this is that people seem to be overlooking the fact that the tips are actually subsidizing the employer. I mean, the rap from the National Restaurant Association and the industry is always, hey, you raise minimum wage, you're taking money out of workers' pockets. And that's not true at all, unless you forget that there's an elephant right there in the room. Your study went through this in detail. Why don't you explain that to the listeners?
Yeah, so the way the tip system works is complicated, and this is part of the problem. It's so complicated that a lot of tip workers themselves don't even know what they're making per hour. The way it works is, as I said earlier, there's a base tipped minimum wage. So in Louisiana and other parts of the South, it's $2.13 per hour. Tipped employers, so restaurants, for example, or bars, only have to pay their tip staff $2.13 an hour on the assumption that the tips that they're receiving are going to bring them up to the regular minimum wage. So, I mean, if you kind of think through how this would play out in real life, it would mean that, okay, when a tip worker, let's say a restaurant worker, a server, shows up for work, on Monday for lunch, the moment they step through the door, in theory, they're making $7.25 an hour, at least. But as soon as they start receiving tips, that base pay that their employer has to pay them is instantly reduced. The employer essentially is capturing a portion of those tips when they lower that base wage down to $2.13 an hour. So basically, employers are capturing about $5 an hour in tips that every tipped worker receives because they're able to just cut paychecks down to that $2.13. And that is a subsidy for those businesses. That's money that would otherwise be going to the worker that is instead allowing the business to have lower labor costs than they really would if they were operating in any other industry. This is the part that I think is so amazing, is that, you know, this system, imagine if this system existed for other industries, like car salesmen, for example. Imagine if a car salesman, every time they sold a car, their employer could just take their commission right out of their base salary. People would be going nuts. They would never stand for that sort of system, but that's the way it is in the restaurant industry and other tipped industries.
And David, let's be honest, you're actually in that report being kind to people, because passing that $5 or whatever that $10, that difference is that the workers are subsidizing employers, also means the employers aren't paying the other 20, 25, 30% of the package, which is taxes, yeah. Social Security payments, whatever. So this is not only a problem that doesn't go away, this is a problem that keeps on penalizing the workers for the rest of their lives and as long as they live, because it means, you know, what you're getting for Social Security payments on $2.13 or whatever it is, $3.39 or whatever it is in D.C. is peanuts compared to what you're getting on a full package on the wages and benefits. So it just cascades it. So, I mean, I don't know if it's $5 on a regular federal minimum wage worker, then it's really more like $7 or $7.50 when you really worry about the whole deal. So, it just is, it's amazing. I mean, you can tell I'm usually pretty measured. Well, I'm probably lying to say I'm measured on my own show, but the top of my head's blowing off. I mean, it's just like, I can't believe they're trying to get away with this. Now, what were workers like? You said that they showed no respect to workers at the hearing. I know some of those workers are even unionized in the hotels and whatever. What are people saying as they heard this sort of, you know, wildness? Well, David, I apologize. I think we just got hacked by the National Restaurant Association. But we were talking right before we briefly went off the air about the hidden subsidies, or it's not hidden at all, the direct subsidies. There was another point you made in the report that's worth sharing about the difference in tips that are received by African-American workers versus white workers.
Yeah, so there's huge disparities in pay between white workers and black workers here in D.C. You know, I found that black workers in D.C. Typically make about 23% less per hour than their white counterparts. So, you know, and it's really interesting that that's the case, because when you looked at the tip workers that were testifying against raising the base wage, they were predominantly white folks who were testifying. And I think that basically just says that to the extent that council members were hearing from tip workers, they were maybe hearing only from the folks that were doing just fine under the current system. I also found that women tipped workers tend to make significantly less than their male counterparts. On an hourly basis, tipped women make about 8% less per hour, but on an annual basis, they make about 20% less. And part of the reason for that is because women tend to, at least in D.C., work fewer hours in these tipped occupations. And we can kind of assume that a portion of that difference in hours is probably not voluntary. In other words, women either have, you know, care responsibilities that prevent them from working more hours, or, you know, the employers are just giving preference to the male servers for whatever reason. And that's plausible, because we know from all kinds of research that women face significant disadvantage, women and people of color face significant disadvantage in negotiating with employers, unless they're in a union. And in tipped occupations, workers don't really negotiate for salary, they negotiate for schedule, because schedule determines who's going to get the best tips, who's going to get the best tables, and therefore who's going to have the highest income. And so we can assume that tipped women and tipped black workers and Hispanic workers, when they're negotiating for their schedules, are probably facing those same disadvantages that they would face when negotiating salary if they were in any other type of job.
We're talking to David Cooper of the Economic Policy Institute and Deputy Director of EARN in Washington, D.C. Now, David, obviously the income is also reflected seasonally, whether it's in D.C. or New Orleans or any place where the hospitality industry is significant. And if women are in an ununionized, non-unionized situation, it's going to be picks and chooses, and often they're not the most senior people anyway.
Right.
So it's just, what a double bind. What's the hope here? Are the proponents of the initiative looking at the vote and saying that if the council does go back on this, that they'll put it back on the ballot, or is this just going to be one that we just take on the jaw, or what are people thinking in D.C. at this point?
I don't think that this is the end of this conversation whatsoever, because, you know, clearly the voters here in D.C. want this to happen. So if the council overturns it, I think it's going to go right back on the ballot at some point in the next few years. And we also know that similar proposals are being advanced in other states. New York State has talked about raising and eliminating their tip minimum wage. There's a measure in Michigan to do the same thing. And, you know, so I think that we haven't heard the last word on this debate here in D.C., even if the council does decide to overturn the will of the voters.
Yeah.
My hope, obviously, is that they don't, or that they are able to find some sort of compromise. But unfortunately, at this point, prospects are not looking too good.
Well, some of them won't be reelected. they end up reneging at this level, I would think. So,
yeah.
You know, D.C. is not a hospitality town as much as a government town, but still, in these days and times, people remember if you promise one thing and go another way.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that there were now eight states that were one-wage states and a number of cities. I think in your report you said Flagstaff recently also moved this direction. Could you share with us some of these places that are going the right way?
Sure. So the seven states, there's seven states that have been one fair wage states for a long time. Those are Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, Montana, and Alaska. Hawaii also became one fair wage a few years ago. And then in 2016, there was a ballot measure passed in Flagstaff, Arizona, to also become a one fair wage city. Now, they haven't gotten all the way there yet. I think right now they're at $8 an hour for the tip minimum wage, and the regular minimum wage is something like $10 or $11 an hour. But over the next few years, they're going to be raising that tip minimum wage until they become a one fair wage city. And that's actually, I'm actually really curious to watch what happens in Flagstaff because, you know, as I said, all the research has shown that when you raise the minimum wage, it does exactly what it's supposed to do. It raises pay for tipped workers or regular workers without having any measurable impact on jobs. And I think that in Flagstaff, as this happens, researchers and advocates are going to be watching the numbers in Flagstaff because I think a few years from now we're going to be able to look at Flagstaff and say, you know, see what we told you. Pay for tipped workers has gone up demonstrably, and the restaurant industry and other tipped industries there are still thriving. And hopefully that might change a few minds in places like D.C., or at least on the D.C. Council.
Well, I know when we won the ballot initiative in San Francisco, we took the tip wage up the full way. But I keep trying to remember in this conversation the Santa Fe ordinance, because obviously that's also a big hospitality town. And I remember meeting with them back when, but I can't remember what they did with the tip wage. Do you know the answer there?
Yeah, they unfortunately didn't do anything with it.
Okay.
In Santa Fe, it's still 213.
Well, now I'm embarrassed. No wonder.
That's okay.
No wonder I didn't remember, David. You know, I just blocked that out.
Well,
I'll swear I gave them the right advice. They made us not have followed it.
Well, they did raise their regular minimum wage pretty high, which is a good thing. We just got to get it up for tipped workers as well.
I have to share with you part of this argument that I've been hearing and organizing hospitality workers off and on in New Orleans and many other places over the years. Once I sort of made the mistake or whatever you did, I agreed that we would organize in our union carriage drivers who run a route in the French Quarter. It's a, you know, they're clientele is exclusively tourists. They line up in front of Jackson Square, and for whatever, you know, package you pay, you get a half hour, whatever ride. So once, after we, you know, sort of won the election, whatever, I'll never forget this one meeting as they were talking about bargaining the collective bargaining agreement, where there's all of a sudden an argument between all the members and each other about, is this a job or a hustle? And it went on for a half hour, but that's always stuck with me. If you want service workers, particularly in the hospitality industry, to see this as a job, as a career, as something that, you know, if you go to Europe and many other jurisdictions, this is how people see their work, as opposed to a hustle, how you view tips has to be the critical core issue there, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and that's one of the arguments that folks have been making here in D.C. is that we want to professionalize these jobs. We want to not only have folks be paid more, but have them be respected as professionals, you know, who are doing a craft, providing good service. And as you said, this is the way that the system works in every other country in the world. The U.S. is the only place that has a system like this. You know, if you go to any part of Europe, the service workers, the restaurant servers, are often unionized. And these are good jobs, good middle-class jobs that people are able to make a life on. Whereas here in the U.S., it's kind of like gambling. Some days you might do okay, other days you might not make much money at all. And that's why tipped workers here in the U.S. have poverty rates that are more than double the poverty rates of non-tipped workers.
And in Europe, I know we have some organizations over there, and I can't remember exactly the country, but there's some places where literally if you tip, the server comes back and gives you the money back.
Yeah.
It's a point of professional pride. Now, I know people are thinking we're talking another language and that we're from Mars now, but the whole world is not the United States, and this sort of employer, the real hustle is what the employers have gotten away with all these years, which is making the customers pay the workers. There have been some experiments with restaurants trying to just on their own get rid of this. I know there's some high-end thing that got a lot of publicity in New York. Have you ever looked at that? Has that made a difference, or is it stuck?
Well, you're right. There have been a few places that have tried to eliminate tipping, that incorporate the tips into or incorporate the service charge into either the prices or onto the bill, and then have all the wait staff and servers be paid a regular salary. You know, in a handful of restaurants, it's been fine, and the workers are fine with it. They like getting a stable paycheck. In others, there's been some opposition, and I think, you know, part of that is because it's hard for one business to make that change on its own when all of its competitors are still benefiting from the existing system. So it would be hard for any restaurant to adopt this totally new model when all their competitors are able to undercut them by paying their workers these poverty-level wages.
We could go on, as you can tell, about this topic forever. This is one near and dear to me, but how do people get in touch with you or support EPI and EARN and the work you are doing? Is there a website, email, something?
Yeah, absolutely. So folks should go to www.epi.org to look at all of our research. You can find my reports there. You can also go to earn.us. That's the website for our network of state-level partners. We have a group in Louisiana, the Louisiana Budget Project. Check them out. And you can always find me on Twitter at Metacoop.
Twitter, I don't know if that's a safe medium anymore, but thank you, Dick Cooper, for being with us on this discussion about getting a fair wage for tip workers. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.